great to see so many members of our community here tonight. I'm looking forward to this, as starting the spiritual part of the gift giving instead of the part where I have to find gifts for people, which is horrifying.
It's getting that way.
Yeah.
Can't go to Amanda's shop anymore.
Oh, you can come to my shop, right? That's different. I'm not
going
to. That's a different hat. I don't have that hat on. Before we start tonight, I want to tell you we have one more thing happening here tomorrow. It's not a reading, but it's a get together for people who are interested in indie publishing. Dan Duffy will be holding an evening here for a conversation about independent publishing and getting your work out there. So that's from 7 to 8 tomorrow here, and that is our final event of this season. And then we're looking forward to next year already. We're starting to plan what we have going on, and I want to tell you what we have going on in January so you can get yourselves ready and excited. Our first event will be January 16th, and it's Mike Sperber, and he will be doing his play about Joan of Arc and Dr. Dark in Bedlam. So the next week we have a very exciting event. We are going to be launching the Gloucester High School literary magazine, The Elicitor. They're going to have a reading here with students in their work. So we're very happy to be inviting them here and giving them a place to share their work with the broader community. So that will be on the 23rd of January. And then on the 30th, we have a Rockport Writers Group, which will be having a reading, which includes Joe Ruckheiser and a lot of his co-writers, whom they haven't sent me their list yet, so I can't tell you more. Chuck Francis. I'm not sure if they haven't sent their list yet, so the information about that will be in our email blast, and as well as everything else. We're skipping the open mic in January because we'll be in hibernation and nobody will be able to move because they've had too much eggnog. So we will see you in February for the open mic after that. And we'll have a whole season announced in the blast in January. So the gift of a poem. Is there anything better than having a poem written for you or writing a poem for somebody else? And you carry those words with you for your whole life. And sometimes you carry the poems that other people have written for other people as if they were written for you. Or the memory of the poem is a gift in itself. So I'm really happy to have you here to share the poems that are gifts in one way or another to you. And we're going to start with Jay Featherstone.
I have two presents tonight. The first present, I think, is a sign that this gathering has a certain energy beyond our own energy. I was walking in Cambridge near Central Square, and I saw, do you see the Farini sign there?
Oh.
That's new. We just put it up now. That metal plate was in the street next to some used books that somebody had put out.
Oh. Wow.
Wow, indeed. Think about that. We are meaning-making animals, right? So we're going to go to town with that. What?
Did you look at the books?
The books weren't poetry. They were pretty interesting books. But and my second present sets us off for the season. It was originally a poem that I wrote for a friend of mine who was going through a pretty rough patch for his birthday. I offer it tonight to you. Today, of course, loss is always the lesson. My topic today, however, is the philosophic mind, the bright eye of happiness. And what can you do about that, old knight? Brothers, sisters, we are as close to heaven as it gets. Sending, receiving, however small, we are the mirrors on this mountain. I caught a mouse eating my crumbs. Surprise pierced his thistle seed eyes. He had brown and gray fur, soft as a mole's, a tail to die for. I set him free on the granite stoop. If he were like me this past sorry season, he would be busy repenting his sins now, vowing never again, hating his captive self, fretting the future of mouse orphans with no health plans. But if he's like me this morning, he's rising up in fresh wonder, whiskers quivering in amazement, calling out, "Is there any living thing not given to song?" Thanks.
Vincent Farini was incredibly generous to his friends. He chronicled our lives in poetry. So it's amazing to see that sign and that synchronicity, because all day I was looking through old poems by Vincent and feeling him, as several of us were. This he wrote to me in 1977, so a long time ago. Too much space. What does the spirit have? And talk, where did it go? A trolley on whose tracks? Who pockets the wind off a wave? Any moment the tiger's claws clamp on. What do we have in common but our carriages? A brain's gizzard, clouds, solitary spiders, and one red evening on sands of purple. Two grounded angels were lifted off a dragon's breath. Finanzio.
Next we have George Story.
I am, in fact, a writer. I'm not a poet. I actually get money every month because I'm a writer. Isn't that unusual?
It is.
I actually end up paying taxes at the end of the year. It's unbelievable. I just very recently, this past weekend, matter of fact, had something come up. We took the grandchildren to the MFA, and we saw the Winnie the Pooh exhibit. And it's wonderful. If you haven't been, you got to go. It really is. And I walked into one of the rooms where the exhibit kind of swayed you around along with all the people that were traveling through, and I banged into a wall that had a large staircase. And on the wall, I was immediately thrown back to being 6 years old. My mother knew every nursery rhyme and poem, child's poem, that you can possibly imagine. And this particular poem was written by A.A. Milne. Whether he did it before or after Winnie the Pooh became popular, I don't know. But let me just add one more thing before I go on and read this. Not only is the exhibit a really nice exhibit about A.A. Milne, and you get his story, his illustrator, Peter Shepard, he's the guy that really made Winnie the Pooh come to life. And I was really very, very taken by how Walt Disney, when they picked up that mantle, stayed very true to Shepard's vision. The piece that was on the wall was on the wall of a staircase. And I remember laying in bed and my mother saying, "Halfway down the stairs is a stair where I sit. There isn't any other stair quite like it. I'm not at the bottom. I'm not at the top. So this is the stair where I always stop. Halfway up the stairs is an up. Halfway, and it isn't down. It isn't in the nursery, and it isn't in the town. And all sorts of fun thoughts run through my head. It isn't really anywhere. It's somewhere else instead.
Next, we have Kate Seidman.
Started writing a book after Mitch died. Many of you probably knew him. And I sent it off to an editor. It came back, and I read it, and I was like, so many words, blah, blah. So many words. There were too many words, so I thought, I'm going to just make it into a graphic memoir. Now, I've decided not only am I going to make it into a graphic memoir, it's also going to be a piece of art that you can hang on the wall. So, I don't know if you can see this, but this is a poem that I'm going to read. So I'm just going to have it here next to Vincent. So you can kind of look at it while I'm reading it. I don't know if you can see it, but this is called Away. Death came to our house, swallowing up, taking away my husband, my children's father. Powerless to change what is, my only choice is to have gratitude. Without him, I am cold. I follow the sun around the house. The sun promises to keep me warm. I watch at the water's edge, the sweet farewell, the song of puffy pinks and baby blues seen at dusk in the distance. Now, the night swallows up the sun again, over and over. Goodbye, I whisper, wishing my husband could be like the sun and return in the morning.
That was nice, Kate. Appreciate hearing that. Mitch was a wonderful man. We all loved him. So, when Vincent published No Fish Here, he wrote on the cover something like, Henry, 166 and 233. And then he wrote something I couldn't read. And I still haven't figured out what it is. But this is one poem that he wrote as a gift to me. It's a short poem. I will try to do it justice. When Vincent wrote No Fish, he had this epiphany about wanting to speak in the Italian-American vernacular. And he wrote a whole bunch of these poems in here that he called the songs. So this is one of the songs. It's called Dream Rida for Henry Farini. And I'm going to kind of cop Joanne Castagna's version of Vince, because I think she did like the best version of anybody about Vincent Farini. So I'm gonna use that as a frame to read this. And that sign is unbelievable. I'm really sorry that Willie Alexander's not here, because he should have been walking through the door just now. But Central Square was his haunt, and I'm sure he would have he's going to love hearing that story and seeing that sign. So anyhow, Dream Rida, R-I-D-A. A hunk of sod all seed has tansy for germane. The four elements have a fifth. The four elements have a fifth. Hess house is Indian grain. Now I'm going to read that again because I read that wrong. The four elements have a fifth. He's house is Indian grain. Here's the wacky pollen. Fuck off, Stalin. But that's, I'm sorry, I fucked that up too, because it's fuck off Stalin. So as in stallion, as opposed to our dictator, Stalin. A Heraclitus hankering for action, selecting ingredients from the garbage. I copped out coping with zigzagging parts and echo music on a star bridge. Here's to the Orphic, all free euphoric. Dream Rider, Vince. Who's next, Amanda?
It's Dorothy.
Ah, Dorothy.
Let me just say to start that I have loved everything I've heard so far. It's just been awesome. Vincent wrote this in 2000. I was renting a room in East Gloucester, and I had just come from a visit with him in this house, and he gave me the copy, and I just was blown away. And I said, I'm going to send this to the New Yorker. And so I went back to the room where I was working, and I didn't tell him, I didn't think he really knew where I was renting this room. But in about 20 minutes, he showed up and banged on the door and said, don't send it to the New Yorker. I have to make some corrections. So we made the corrections. I haven't sent it yet. That I'm not going to try. No way could I do Joanne or even you. But the one thing, if I had time, I would have put a check mark beside those lines where he would say, you know, really make a point, right? And they're here. He would stop and make a point and look at you. And I'll do the best I can. This is I think it might have been published in the Gloucester Daily Times. For Pat Roberts, my view request about the power of poetry and the future. You have a keen social conscience, as many others do, and practice their faith in a working democracy. We are confronting a prosperity millions are at the edge of. There has always been a split between life and art. The false, irreconcilable condition. My earliest realization was accepting the unity of opposites. Therein, I owned peace of mind in spite of the grave split. Poems came in the most direct means of healing and a way out of the conflict, thus a warrior without a shield. Poetry was a natural breathing. Poetry was a natural, breathing it because the air of that afflatus carried me, a constant, so writing poems was uninterrupted. They are a documentation of my life and times. I never expected anything from it, nada, niente. So you ask me about contests? I don't believe in contests. I don't believe in them. Not when the poem's nature is in everything and everyone sleeping and awake. Competition as fun and games raconteurs. To show and win my own worth when I know who and what I am, striding in my own boots? How can I be bottled when the sky waters are racing, tumbling down the Alps to the sea with our astrological relationships? For the first time, the American citizens are split 50-50 in the undercurrents of society. Our mothers and sisters evolving through re-seeing and adding to the wisdom. The heart of the poem in tune with the engine, mapping the qualities of experience. All ages and eons are the shades of today. So I don't hope but go driving with the moments, in direct confrontation of things as they are, recording those songs fortified with a united self. The more I am, the more I give out. No walking in shadows content. Waiting for someone to tell you who you are is separating yourself from your quintessential assets in limbo. Okay? Quintessential. Help me out, Jay. Waiting for someone to tell you who you are is separating yourself from your quintessential assets in limbo. In limbo. Earth is the leading character. As you are, so is the world. Isolation, I lost myself, is the myth of the media. No one is alone. Fulfilling the poem that is not on the paper or in the book, but alive in your imagination, that powerhouse generator. Action and word are so often aborted, causing much suffering, that when they exhibit their angst and fears, the air shivers from the contact in a lightning learning. Joe Garland's poem of himself in contesting the judge's crude remark reversed that emotional flaw, and these two taught us a lesson from the law's interbreedings. The creative is inexhaustible, the source of all the joys and wealth. Anyone in rhythm possesses the cosmos. Every gene synchronizing. These words are catalysts. They are messengers and messages of the sought for. Words and images are generally quarreling for dominance, their unities and mysteries always instigating me to marry them. Even though there are two establishments, the commercial and the elite, that keep them divided. The matrix of thoughts and deeds trumping them, the real and the ideal of fructifying in the soul's body. That there is not enough is the curse of humanity, delaying and impeding total liberation from the exigencies of economics. The process of the divinity in the essence of engagement, spiritual intercourse, from a leaf to the roots of the trees in the airs of Our Lady, hearing the music of the heart-mind. The architecture of the poem is anyone writing, singing, or silent. The architecture of the poem is anyone writing, singing, or silent. Hierarchy's two obstacles are the id and the ego. Daemon, dynamo, is idling. Greed is the last monarchy to be dethroned. Get the precisions of the poem into Congress for the love of life values, and we are making it in our seaport.
Thank you, Dorothy.
It's the manifesto.
I think so. It's very timely.
Next, we have Anita. Do you know?
So, good evening. So, I'm going to read something from someone who's very dear to my heart. Many of you probably know of his work, John O'Donohue, the Irish theologian, teacher, scholar, writer. And this is from his work, his last published work just before he died, called To Bless the Space Between Us. Mm-hmm. So this is a blessing. Maybe that's what every poem is. And this is one of my favorites, although this book is just chock full of beautiful work. This has been given to me by the universe and passed on to many, many people. In fact, I used to work for a brief time for North Shore Medical Center, and one of my jobs in psychiatry was going to nursing homes and doing evaluations and treatment with elders there. And it was very difficult. I used to sit outside and say, how am I going to get up my energy to walk in there and have a positive effect? And I did not see my role as just medicating people. So I would have to ask people all these clinical questions and do assessments. And some of the elders would, one day, one of the women said to me, "Really, when are you going to stop with the clinical questions?" And I said, "Well, I'm sorry I had to do that, but now would you like to hear something a little more soothing?" So I read her this, and it was a gift. And then I realized that to offset the clinical aspect of my visits, I could bring John O'Donohue in with me. So this one is called A Blessing of Angels. May the angels in their beauty bless you. May they turn toward you streams of blessing. May the angel of awakening stir your heart to come alive to the eternal within you, to all the invitations that quietly surround you. May the angel of healing turn your wounds into sources of refreshment. May the angel of the imagination enable you to stand on the true thresholds, at ease with your ambivalence and drawn in new directions through the glow of your contradictions. May the angel of compassion open your eyes to the unseen suffering around you. May the angel of wildness disturb the places where your life is domesticated and safe. Take you to the territories of true otherness, where all that is awkward in you can fall into its own rhythm. May the angel of Eros introduce you to the beauty of your senses, to celebrate your inheritance as a temple of the Holy Spirit. May the angel of justice disturb you to take the side of the poor and the wronged. May the angel of encouragement confirm you in worth and self-respect, that you may live with the dignity that presides in your soul. May the angel of death arrive only when your life is complete and you have brought every given gift to the threshold where its infinity can shine. May all the angels be your sheltering and joyful guardians.
Next, Martin Ray.
This poem is exactly 5 1/4 years old. It came on the occasion of a granddaughter, Audrey. It's called Audrey's News. Flash, I'm here. The new sister, daughter, wonder of Indiana, lucky in love. Mommy and Daddy had adventures bringing Lillian and Vivian into the world. I'm smooth. The girls had their Barbie bags packed beside the door for the rush that never came. I'm smooth. Mommy and Daddy were cool. No doctor, no doula in the room, just whispers. I slipped out. Slipped into my family's open arms. Now they can tell the world about me, Audrey Tova Ray. I love my name. Tova is the center. Daddy's grandma who was the way. I'm glad I'm a girl, so I get to be like mommy. She cares for everybody, and I came through her. Later today, Lily and Vivi will come to meet me. I've been hearing their song all my life. We're going to have fun. Daddy's right here. My birth interrupted his laugh, but it'll come back. It always does. He's awed into quiet. He's going to dance with me and take me to see the ocean in Gloucester. They're getting ready to tell me about God. I'll show them what I already know, and we'll grow together. I haven't actually been home yet. They've been shifting the rooms around to fit me in. They're going to need a bigger car. They loved. I didn't expect this. Oof. They loved me enough to do all that before they even met me. We can touch each other now. That's the first thing I noticed. We're giving each other smiles. I hear doors opening. I hear rhythms. Oh, my soul. Oh, my soul. From Papa Martin.
Thank you, Martin. Elizabeth?
Well, as you can tell, mine's a little bit different than Martin's. Paper's a little bit frayed. But
how
I was going.
How old is that one?
Probably 1976. I moved to Mount Vernon, Maine, which had 750 people in it. Today it has 1,500. And this was inspired by a town hall meeting in Mount Vernon about 19, I think my son might have been born, so it might have been five. And it was inspired by, I mean, it was just an accident, but my mother was an early childhood teacher. And just according to what you said, I had gotten her a copy of Winnie the Pooh in Latin when it came out when I was 15. I thought it would be a cute thing because she took Latin in high school because it was called Winnie Il Pooh. So this day I went down to the meeting, and they needed somebody to take care of the children. Well, the parents were in the meeting. And the only place they had was in the cellar of the Odd Fellows Hall, which is where they had their meetings at the time. They didn't have a town hall, which they built later. And I wanted to buy the Odd Fellows Hall. I wanted them to buy it, and there was no plumbing, but they got a trailer, you know, a prefab. So that's what they did. And so I went down, played with the children, keep them busy and everything, and I came up, and I sat down at the meeting, and the parents, maybe some of them left. And somebody up there, I don't know, on the dais or part of the board, looked up, and he looked at me, and he said, Elizabeth, do you have anything to say? You haven't been here. I said, oh, I went down and volunteered to take care of the kids, and I've been in the cellar too long. So then I went home, and this came to me. I mean, it's not spiritual, it might be, but it's very funny. And it just came like that, and it doesn't happen. I think I've done four like this. And the title of it is I've Been in the Cellar Too Long. I've been in the cellar too long, and that's why I'm writing this song. My sump pump is broken, though only a token of my troubles and what's going wrong. The windows are covered to keep out the cold. I can't see outside as I'm growing old. And I don't even know if the whole town's been sold, for I've been in the cellar too long. Mm-hmm. My wood pile's diminished. I'm told that I'm finished. The hay can be hewn for compost in June. There's no end in sight, for it's always the night. Oh, I've been in the cellar too long. It wasn't so bad getting water in bottles. My car has a heater to help out the throttle. The pipes are all frozen from the sink and the toilet, and I have been told I must get a destroylet. Did you ever hear of this? Valkyries and Furies, good gurus out there, won't you listen and help me? Please answer my prayer. Oh, I've been in the cellar too long. Catalina, Torino, a dreamlike warm places. Around here, their names to be used in the races. The sounds in the cellar are car wheels with studs. I know because my ears hear them tearing through mud. The snowplow goes by, making ravines and high banks. From here it sounds like a half track or tank. Please come to my bunker. Let me know when it's spring. My guitar is so warped, I can't even sing. Or is it my pipes? For I've been, my cup runneth over. Or is it my pipes? For I've been in the cellar too long.
We need some humor.
I wish this would happen again. Thank you. It's been great to hear everything.
it's been, I mean, a gift in itself just to hear these stories and so many connections to each of them. Martin, that was incredible. Just, Audrey was totally worth that poem. I, too, am going to read a poem by A.A. Milne, and this is a book that Garrett Lansing gave to my children. And he would recite this to them when they were little. We would go to Trader Joe's, and he would be pushing the grocery cart and playing with the kids and making ridiculous noises and things like that that he hadn't had the opportunity to do before, having never pushed children in carriages through the supermarket. So I was going to read something else about, but this is it. We're going for disobedience. James Morrison Morrison Weatherby George Dupree took great care of his mother, though he was only three. James said to his mother, "Mother," he said he, "you must never go down to the end of town if you don't go down with me." James Morrison's mother put on a golden gown. James Morrison's mother drove to the end of town. James Morrison's mother said to herself, said she, "I can get right down to the end of town and be back in time for tea." King John put up a notice, "Lost or stolen or strayed. James Morrison's mother seems to have been mislaid. Last seen wandering vaguely, quite of her own accord, she tried to get down to the end of the town, 40 shillings reward." James Morrison Morrison, commonly known as Jim, told his other relations not to go blaming him. James said to his mother, "Mother," he said he, "you must never go down to the end of town without consulting me." James Morrison's mother hasn't been heard of since. King John said he was sorry, so did the Queen and Prince. King John, "Somebody told me," said to a man he knew, "if people go down to the end of town, well, what can anyone do?" Now, very softly, J.J.M.M.W.G. Dupee took great care of his mum, though he was only three. J.J. said to his M.M., he said he, "You must never go down to the end of town if you don't go down with me." Next, we have Susan.
Henry already introduced this book, No Fish, but this is book three. So No Fish book three was the first book that Vincent gifted me. He gifted me all of his books when I met him in 2004, shortly after I moved here. Richard Emanuel had introduced us. So Vincent and I clicked, and I didn't realize how much until I started going through the book. Now, the book itself, book three, is basically what I consider a tapas of Vincent Farini. So the first section is called 10 Pound Light, and it's basically poetry, you know, a potpourri. The second part is the dreams, and this is related to his relationship with Olson and Maximus. The third part is called the public love letters, which are the letters he wrote to what used to be a decent paper, the Gloucester Daily Times, and he would wax poetic about any issue that was relevant to him, and every issue was relevant to Vincent. The fourth part was called The Navigators, and this was kind of an overview of interesting characters in the community, some of whom I befriended because of reading this. And then the fifth part is called Baseball, and it was Vincent's play that was produced at the Old West End Theater in 1986. Now, I don't know why it was called Baseball, because it is so relevant for today, because it was about developers coming in to this area and exploiting the beauty, the infrastructure, everything about Gloucester. And of course, this is a recent thing with Espresso property and what they want to do. And the Writers' Center has already taken a position, and I certainly hope that is sustainable. So anyway, so when going through the book, Vincent had flagged a couple of the poems, and I thought, oh my God, I hardly knew the man. And he knew me. He wrote me a lot of love poetry. You know, I don't want to share that. Anyway, I thought, wow, this man really picked up where I was coming from. So this is called Two. T-W-O. Live with me, but not in the same house. Lay with me, but not in one room. Engage me, but don't have any fixed notions. Sup with me, but not at the same table. So I thought, whoa. So I have written a haiku in honor of Vincent, and it's called No Vincent, K-N-O-W. Alas, he is no more. But we, whose souls entwine to each like the bending seaweed, know Vincent.
Next is Jenny.
Oh. Hi. I've had an interesting experience with giving poems as gifts. I haven't done it that much, but the majority of the times, the few times I have, I haven't seen the person again. So I think that's a little hard, like a little heavy, getting the projection of the deep emotional poet sometimes. I don't know. So I actually did it recently, and the same thing happened. And, you know, it's a different context, but still. So then I decided to write myself a love letter. I've also been listening to a course on self-compassion. So before you can have, you know, that's the way to cultivate compassion for others. So I decided to write this for myself. But when I was rewriting it, I realized it's really for everybody, any reader or listener. But if I look up and you guys are gone when I finish, then I'll know that I shouldn't give poems as gifts at all, ever. This is called Love Letter. You who are always so empty, always trying so hard to fill up, I watch you rise every morning, an empty pail. I write to remind you what you already know, in the very fishbones of your sea, of the invisible, the indestructible. Even if you make mistakes, even the ones you call the killer whales, even if you can't save the world or even one tidal pool, even if you say all the wrong things, even as you open up your voice like a great clam finally rising to the beach and then fear it was all wrong. Everything has a symmetry in its own place. You pass a mangled lobster trap, all mash and angles, rust, rope, blue nylon, fish line, severed orange finger of glove, wet sand mounded throughout. You pull your hood tight against the whipping cold, yet you keep on walking in your own way, trash bag in hand down the shoreline. Look, the ocean falls and rises up to you unbidden. Spray leaps off crests in breathless attempts to fly. There's a shadow on the underside of the barrel of each wave, always chasing the shining smoothness one pace ahead. And there's a moment before the wave breaks, where it taffies into aquamarine, alive with light inside, like you, a translucent liquid shell. Then falls into crawling crumbles of froth, a skittering, clamoring chaos. My love, my dove-white dissolution, my thundering shadow, my eternal illuminated whirl. You're still here.
Hopefully that broke the curse.
I
have Georgelina.
I actually have two fairly short poems. One is by Michael Foley. You might know him. He's from Gloucester. And I had his poems on display on my little store until recently, I've closed the store. But I find that his poems, my perception of them is that they carry galactic energy. It comes from something completely, I have no words to describe it. At the same time, I feel they go to the core of the human experience in the context of universe. Don't ask me what that means, but those are the words that come to me when I think about his poems. I believe they need to be preserved. I believe they carry a message that doesn't come through maybe on the first reading. I think there's a lot in there that humanity needs to receive, perceive, etc. He has given me permission to share his poems in any way I want. So I've put them, it's a very homemade binder, but if the center wants to have them, here they are. It's only a few, that's all. All he has. So that's for him. So from him. This poem is called Journey Reborn, and it's about soulmates finding each other after a long time. And now blurry eons have passed since the walking out on a hazy summer morn, sun rays piercing brambles and naked branches along the rutted and weary way. And the steps begin small and tentative, led by memories vague and ancient of a journey once begun. Excuse my accent, my diction is a disaster. Anyways, keep going, Jay-Z, just keep going. And like wild honey, the morning passes as the touch of daylight once again begins, fingers of awakening souls once more entwined, embraced by breeze soft and languid, and the steps lengthen, fluid and rhythmic, while the roadway smooths and straightens for a journey yet rejoined. And the circle turns as in days before, as morning blends to brilliant clear midday, and souls once sidely divided are again united, the pathway untroubled and reformed, the steps pause a moment to hold and behold the splendor of a world renewed and a journey reborn. And this is a poem that I wrote. I went a long time ago to the funeral of a baby, and this came to me. These are thoughts for a grieving young father. Dear Jimmy, your baby is gone, but is he really? In eternity, the bond of love remains untouchable, unbreakable. In the depths of our being, we carry eternity, Jimmy. In the depths of our being, we carry God. God within you, eternity within you, your baby within you. Your baby is gone, but is he really? Look with the eyes of the soul, Jimmy, within you. Feel your baby with the senses of the soul within you. Hold your baby with the love of your soul within you, and as you learn to see with the eyes of the soul within you, you will find that your baby is not gone, not really. Your baby is with you, within you, in eternity, within you, forever and ever.